You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, flowers look good, smell good, and some of them taste good, too. Our guest tells us about the edible flowers available here in Wisconsin. First, the state is home to dozens of poultry processing plants, and a new report is shedding light on the working conditions some of their employees may face. The industry's had one of the highest rates of severe injury, worse than jobs like coal mining and gas extraction, and injuries may be underreported. Sarah Shipley-Hiles is an assistant professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. She was the project editor for a student-reported investigation into conditions in poultry plants out yesterday from the Wisconsin Center on Investigative Journalism, originally reported for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what led you to tackle the poultry industry and injury rates there?
Well, it was through a collaboration with the Midwest Center. I approached them with my class, investigative reporting class, and said that we were interested in working with them, and together we came up with that story. The poultry processing industry has been known to be dangerous for many years, so it's not a new story in some ways, but what is surprising about it is that some of these conditions still persist.
Yeah, talk about the kind of jobs we're talking about and the pace of these jobs.
Yes. Poultry processing plants have a thing called a line where the chickens are actually moving down a mechanical line and the workers stand there at their stations and do things like cut and clip them. And the speed of that line has been noted as a concern in a lot of studies that have been done on the industry. So it's the speed at which the chickens go by and the workers are supposed to attend to them. And the line speed can be up to 140 chickens per minute, and by getting a waiver, the plants can sometimes go even faster.
Now talk about some of the injuries that do get reported. What are some of the common things we see in these plants?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the injuries that we looked at included serious injuries that would be amputations, especially finger amputations seem to be fairly common, where workers get their fingers actually cut or clipped in the machinery. Those would be reported definitely to OSHA, which is a federal agency that oversees workplace safety. But there's another concern, and that is maybe less serious injuries, like repetitive motion injuries that happen very commonly, but those are not required to be reported to OSHA. So there's a great concern that people are actually being injured in a chronic way and that it isn't necessarily being reflected.
Let's focus in on those acute injuries, the first ones you mentioned. What do these companies say about how they try to train people and deal with safety issues?
Well, they do provide training, of course. And one of the plants that we looked at is in Sedalia, Missouri. It's a Tyson plant. And Tyson did speak to us a little bit about the training that they provide. And we had one employee who was willing to go on the record with us and even let us use her name. And she said that she did feel comfortable with the training that she received. But at the same time, the positions are inherently very dangerous and difficult just because of the nature of the task. Employees are working in a very cold and wet environment, and they have a lot of safety gear on, which is needed to protect them, but at the same time makes it cumbersome for them to move and very uncomfortable.
Talking to Sarah Shipley-Hiles from the University of Missouri School of Journalism and a project she worked on with students there looking at occupational safety in poultry processing plants. And now let's turn to those chronic injuries, the repetitive motion types of things. What kind of things did you see, you and your journalists see talking to workers at these plants?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very common because the workers do stand there all day long on their shifts and they do the same types of motion over and over again. So apparently there used to be a requirement or a place, I guess I should say, on the injury reporting forms that collected data about these repetitive motion injuries, but that was actually removed from the form. And so there's literally not a place anymore for these types of injuries to be reported in the same way. And so there's a concern that everybody knows that these injuries are happening, but maybe they're not as well documented and not as well provided for. And then when you consider just the speed and the very nature of the work, that's where a lot of the concern comes in. So if employees are doing these very strenuous manual tasks, especially working with their hands, wrists, and arms all day long, and they start to feel stress, pain, and injury. They might not have an injury that gets reported because maybe they're just moved to a different task within the plant, and that doesn't result in an actual reportable type of injury.
So
but they are actually still suffering.
So when we see federal reporting, that's more looking at there was an individual incident that caused injury, not a cumulative toll taken by the nature of the job.
Yes, definitely. So if someone slips and falls, that was mentioned in one of our stories. If someone has a fingertip cut off, that would certainly be reported. But these more chronic types of things are not necessarily being reported.
And is there any indication that any factors are trying to say, okay, hey, we've got this repetitive motion a problem for a lot of our workers. What can we do to fix that?
Well, there's certainly attention to these concerns. There are both federal agencies that have drawn attention to it, as well as a lot of nonprofit groups that are working on the issue. So, for example, the GAO has put out several reports in recent years that are linked in our stories that point out that, you know, we really need to address these problems, and they have been known for some time. We need to gather better data and then see what we can do within the plant environment to, you know, maybe engineer better solutions.
Another issue that came up in your reporting is that these are often jobs done by immigrant workers, and there may be language issues when it comes to safety and training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, the poultry processing industry has been known as being very welcoming and friendly to immigrants and even refugees. So people who may come here with no language skills and little job skills that might work in other environments can get positions in these plants. And sometimes they are, you know, dangerous and dirty jobs that maybe might not be as attractive to some other people. So it can be an appealing place for some folks to get their foot in the door, to get a good paying job. However, you know, that results in a situation that could be ripe for abuse. So I think the statistic was almost 30% of workers in the meat and poultry processing industry are foreign-born, and about 35% are Hispanic. So that's a pretty significant chunk, and that means that people may have issues with, there may be a language barrier there, there may be cultural barriers there, and so people's immigration status may also play into it if they, whether or not they would actually be turned in or have their status discovered, they may be afraid to complain or afraid to ask for things because they're concerned about their immigration status. So there could be a fear factor there.
On a practical level, your reporting also found concerns about access to bathrooms and bathroom breaks. Is that right?
Yes. This is an issue that's been reported pretty extensively in some of the investigations that have gone on. And apparently, it's quite common for people to either say that they were denied access to the bathroom or discouraged from using the bathroom to the point that some people said that they would not eat or drink during their entire shift so that they wouldn't have to use the bathroom. And things like urinary tract infections and abdominal pain and constipation, and that can lead to more serious problems like kidney problems, can result from that.
Did you come across any efforts? We talked a little bit about the factory safety efforts themselves. Is anybody advocating for better safety regulations, slowing down the speed of the line, anything like that to try to avoid some of the problems we've been talking about?
Yes, there's been long-time efforts really going on in a number of states. And the Northwest Arkansas Workers Justice Center is one that we touched on in our reporting, and they have really been very active in working on this. But in the state of Missouri as well, there are a number of nonprofit organizations that are working on it and a number of federal investigations that have gone on. So I would say that the injury rate has declined. It's not that nothing has been done over the years, but the industry remains one of the more dangerous ones compared to other types of manufacturing. So even though there has been some improvement, there's still a lot more that could be done.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sarah Shipley-Hiles, assistant professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism and project editor of a student reporting project looking into conditions in poultry processing plants. It was originally published by the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, and you can find the story online at wisconsinwatch.org. First, while flowers are beautiful to look at and great to smell, they can also be tasty, even a tad spicy, in meals and in drinks. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you eat certain types of flowers? How do you use flowers in your cooking? And do you have questions about harvesting or finding edible flowers? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Danny Lind spent 10 years as the produce manager and buyer at the Viroqua Food Co-op and now owns and operates Rooted Spoon Culinary, a catering business that focuses on local seasonal foods. She uses a lot of edible flowers in her catering and is here to share some of her knowledge. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Rob.
So I'm not a big flower eater myself. How did you first come across the world of edible flowers?
Well, you know, I remember very distinctly the first time I ever ate a flower, and it was in sixth grade at camp in northern Minnesota, and we were spending the day pretending to be voyageurs, the French-Canadian fur trappers, and we were learning how they hunted and foraged for a lot of their foods, and so at the end of the day, we harvested a bunch of, or I guess it was probably in the middle of the day, a bunch of dandelions and made fritters out of them over the campfire. And I just remember being blown away by that because my mom had a big flower garden and we had a vegetable garden, and I just had never heard of eating flowers, especially not one that I considered to be a weed.
Now, you operate a catering business now, and you use flowers often in your meal planning. What kind of reactions do you get from clients and guests when they see flowers on the plate?
Yeah, you know, fast forward 30 years, I use flowers all the time, especially this time of year. There's rarely a plate that goes out that doesn't have some kind of flower. We actually have a framed picture in the kitchen that says, "Don't forget the damn flowers." There's been a couple times we forgot them and got really mad. But, you know, a lot of our guests will ask, "Are these edible?" And I was like, of course they're edible. We wouldn't put them on the plate if they weren't edible. But we really like to use them a lot as garnish because, you know, they say you eat first with your eyes. And, you know, first impressions are everything. So if we can make a plate a little more beautiful with a splash of color and, you know, an extra nice little fragrance or spice, it just makes things a little more special.
Now, before we get into how to use flowers in our cooking, I want to get into a couple of don'ts. We can't just randomly start picking any old flower, right? We got to know which ones are edible and which ones are really not. Where do we go? How do we figure that out?
Well, you start by don't eat something that if you don't know what it is, and do a little research if you're going to go out foraging. You know, there's some different rules. There's some garden plants that are downright poisonous, like foxglove and lily of the valley and oleander. You definitely don't want to eat those. And then there's some things, some more naturalized things that they aren't necessarily poisonous, but they're going to cause an unpleasant reaction if you touch them, like poison parsnip or cow parsnip. They'll cause it, like skin reaction to you. So you want to be careful with that kind of stuff. So definitely only eat something if you know what it is. You also want to be careful about where you're harvesting. If it's someplace that's been sprayed by chemicals or has any sort of storm sewer runoff, you don't want to eat those things. And you usually don't want to eat any flowers coming from a commercial forest unless it's a commercial forest that specializes in organic plants, because a lot of the flower industry uses chemicals that aren't approved for human use.
We are talking about eating flowers with Danny Lind. She spent 10 years as the produce manager and buyer at the Viroqua Food Co-op, now owns Rooted Spoon Culinary. We're talking about eating flowers, edible flowers, and how to use them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you eat flowers? Do you serve them on a plate? Call in 800-642-1234. She's giving us some advice on how to use them in our cooking, and as we'll find out, in beverages as well. And she's got a list out there of the kind of flowers we can safely eat, and maybe you've got some of them growing in your own garden right now. And we'll go back to Danny now. Danny, I understand some vegetables, they have flowers that are edible. What kind of vegetables should we be watching for in our garden that, hey, it's not just the fruit of the plant we can eat, it's the flower too?
Sure, absolutely. Broccoli is one of them. There's specific types of broccoli you grow as broccoli rob, which is like a flowering broccoli stem. But regular old broccoli, sometimes you can eat the flowers too. Arugula, kale, once it starts to flower, you can eat those. They have really pretty yellow flowers. Peas, radishes, all those things have edible flowers. The yummiest ones probably are zucchini flowers, though. Summer squash flowers, and those you can cook in its own as a vegetable in its own right. You can stuff them, or you can put them in salads or omelets.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because zucchinis are apparently one of the easiest to grow vegetable plants because I can grow them successfully, and they always have these beautiful flowers that I don't know what to do with. So, give us a little more. Do they get cooked or are they raw and we stuff them with stuff? What are some of the options for those beautiful zucchini flowers?
Sure, and they're great to pick, too, because as anyone who's ever grown a zucchini knows, you get way more zucchinis than you need or want, so you might as well pick some of the flowers and have a special treat. I think the yummiest things to do with them are stuffing them, and you can either cook them or leave them raw, but you can stuff them with, like, cheese, mixed with some egg and herbs, and then what's really delicious is to dip them in, like, whipped egg whites and then fry them, but you can also just bake them, and they're delicious, just brushed with some olive oil.
And you know, I've thrown away many a zucchini flower, I guess. What do the flowers taste like?
You know, they're kind of sweet. They kind of taste like squash, but like a really fresh, sweet squash.
And I understand that there are some vegetables where you can eat the stuff, but not the flowers on them. Like tomatoes, do I have that right? We should not be
Correct.
Eating the flower there.
Yep, nightshade families. You know, you can eat the fruit of the nightshade families, but you never want to eat the leaves or the roots or the flowers.
All right, now take us into some flowers that we might not think of as a foodstuff. What are some good ones? If we can get ones that haven't been pesticide-treated heavily, edible ones,
right.
What are some of the yummy flowers that might surprise us on the plate?
So wild ones are ones that are naturalized that you could find walking in the park or if you go to the country and walk down a country road. This time of year, elderberry blossoms are amazing. Daylily petals, like those orange ones that
really
kind of grow wild a lot. They're delicious. They're super sweet and tender. They're just wonderful in a salad, raw, or you can cook with them, put them in a stir fry or something, but I think they're best raw. Wild bergamot is another one that's blooming right now. It's a pale purple flower, and it's very spicy, kind of peppery, and you can eat the whole flower in like a fritter or something, but usually pull the little petals off and use them as a garnish. In the spring, black locust blossoms are one of my favorites. It's a legume, so it has pea-looking flowers. They look like peas, like sweet peas, but they're white and they're very fragrant. They smell almost tropical and they're very sweet. Oh, they're wonderful.
And I understand you've written that you could use a lot of flowers in beverages, too. What do you do with those?
Yeah, so we have a part-time bar here in Viroqua as well, and so we make a lot of different syrups and teas to use both in non-alcoholic drinks and in cocktails. So, you know, we made like a really delicious lilac syrup in the springtime and use that both in non-alcoholic drinks and in cocktails. You can make, we're all pretty familiar with chamomile tea or hibiscus, but you can grow both of those here and have them fresh. There's a cultivated bergamot. I was talking about that light purple wild bergamot, but there's a cultivated garden variety that has red flowers that are much more citrusy and less spicy, and those are delicious in tea too. And clover can go in tea, and also some things that we're used to using their leaves and don't really think of using their flowers, but once they flower out, they're still really good, like basil or mint or lemon balm are all things that the flowers are really delicious too.
Oh, you can use the basil flower, because I always think if I let my basil flower, I've messed up.
No. So, you know, and I was always taught that, too, because I was a vegetable gardener most of my life, and I was always taught once it flowers, the plant's useless. You might as well drink it out. And that can be true. The leaves can get kind of bitter, but basically what the plant is doing is transferring its energy to those flowers instead of the leaves at that point. And so sometimes the flowers will still be sweet and delicious when the leaves are starting to turn bitter.
You mentioned making a syrup with, I think it was the lilac flowers. Now, is that like making a simple syrup and just using the lilac as a flavoring ingredient, or is it a fancier process than that?
No, it is a super simple process. You basically make a simple syrup with either sugar or honey, one part water to one part honey or sugar. And then you bring that to a boil and then turn off the heat and pack it full of flowers. Rose petals are delicious, hibiscus, like I said, lilac, lavender if you're growing it is amazing, basil flowers are incredible, and then just let that steep for about 10, 15 minutes, and then you strain it and stick it in the fridge, and it's good for a week or two.
And then when you make a beverage or a cocktail like that, do you garnish it with the one of the flowers themselves to add that visual back in?
Of course. You want to do this too.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm talking to Danny Lind. She spent 10 years as a produce manager and buyer at the Viroqua Food Co-op, now owns and operates Rooted Spoon Culinary, a catering business. She joined us to share some edible flowers and how to use them in our cooking and, as we just heard, in our beverages. Now, a dozen Russian agents have been charged with hacking into the Democratic National Committee, the Hillary Clinton Presidential Campaign, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein made the announcement on Friday. The 11-count indictment is part of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election.
When we confront foreign interference in American elections, it's important for us to avoid thinking politically as Republicans or Democrats, and instead to think patriotically as Americans.
Today, President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin met in Helsinki. They were asked about the Mueller investigation during a joint news conference and denied any Russian wrongdoing. So what's the takeaway from the Trump-Putin sit-down, and where does the Mueller probe stand today? Katie Herriger is a professor of political science at Wake Forest University and an expert on federal special prosecutors. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
We'll get to that meeting today in just a bit. Well, let's start off with the big news on Friday about these indictments. How big a deal do you see this as being?
Well, I think it's a big deal in terms of sort of showing us where Mueller is going with the investigation. And I think sort of putting the evidence out there that clearly the Russians did attempt to interfere with the election, as our intelligence agency people have been saying. So I think it's significant in the sense that it's out there as a way of sort of a counter narrative to the president's narrative about what's going on. You know, whether he could actually ever prosecute these people is another matter, since they're in another country and they'd have to be extradited.
Yeah, Rosenstein said the Russians belong to the Military Intelligence Service, the GRU. And as you mentioned, we've had an indication since before Election Day that Russian intelligence officials were involved. But having this indictment spelling out the direct involvement of Russian officials, can you talk a little bit about what that means, what we know now?
So I think I was struck by the detail in the indictment. That shows that we had lots of ways of getting this information. In other words, that our counterintelligence people have been on it. So I think we know. I think it's very clear that they interfered with the election, and the president's own director of national intelligence confirms that, as does the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So we now have it from multiple sources.
Now, this was the hot news on Friday, but now today we have the aftermath of this sit-down between President Trump and Russian President Putin and this press conference that's gotten a lot of reaction. And I want to play a moment for this. President Trump is asked toward the end of the conference if he would denounce this Russian interference that we see in the indictment. President Trump talked about Democratic computer servers and then this.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be, but I really do want to see the server. But I have confidence in both parties.
So people are reading this, Katie, as the president of the United States sitting next to President Putin saying he has equal confidence in the entirety of the American intelligence system and Vladimir Putin, the autocratic leader of Russia. What do you make of that?
Yes. Well, it's hard to be surprised anymore when the president does unconventional things. But I think the backlash that you've seen, the bipartisan backlash that you've seen to that statement, tells you that he may have overstepped. And I saw that he later tweeted something where he seemed to be dialing back the statement about the intelligence agencies, you know, or his lack of belief that they had the information. But I think, as I said, he's... I suppose we shouldn't be surprised by things like this. I think what seems different about this is the sort of foreign policy implications of it in ways that I think may be what prompted the criticism from Republicans, who have been, I think, up to this point, reluctant to criticize.
Talking to Katie Harriger, professor of political science at Wake Forest University, talking about the latest news on the Russian probe, the indictments against Russian intelligence officials on Friday, and now this meeting between President Trump and President Putin and the ensuing press conference. I want to read some of the reaction that Katie Harriger just mentioned. Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence in the Trump administration, saying, quote, the role of the intelligence community is to provide the best information, fact-based assessments possible for the president and policymakers. We have been clear in our assessments of Russian meddling in the 2016 election and their ongoing pervasive efforts to undermine our democracy. Paul Ryan, congressman from Wisconsin, a House speaker not running again, says there's no question that Russia interfered in our election and continues attempts to undermine democracy. Moving ahead in that quote, the president must appreciate that Russia is not our ally. Senator Ron Johnson, a second in that, he said, I urge President Trump to forcefully and repeatedly demand that the Putin regime dramatically improve its behavior. And finally, Senator John McCain, another Republican, a quote from his statement, no prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant. So, in order from weakest to strongest reactions there, Katie, is this something that you think is just going to blow over as some past incidents have, or do you see Republican senators and members of Congress calling more attention to this?
Well, I mean, I was struck by the comments that Republicans made today, because as I said, they have been sort of reluctant, I think, to criticize him even. And some members of the House, of course, have agreed with him that this is a witch hunt against him. But if I think of sort of another special prosecutor analogy, in Watergate, for much of the Watergate investigation, the first few years of it, the public was sort of generally thought, well, this is just some kind of political shenanigans. They tended to see it in very quite partisan terms. And then, of course, after Archibald Cox was fired, public opinion changed. And as that public opinion changed, so did, and part of it was Republicans saying you shouldn't have done that, right? So I think when Republican voters hear Republican members of Congress chastise the president, they may be more willing to believe there's something, you know, that the president's behavior in this context is not appropriate.
I want to go back to...
than they would be if it was just Democrats that were criticizing him.
Sure. I want to go back to Rod Rosenstein's announcement on Friday saying, hey, in this indictment, we're talking about foreign actors only. Here's a listen.
There's no allegation in this indictment that any American citizen committed a crime. There's no allegation that the conspiracy changed the vote count or affected any election result.
And some in the Trump administration have really focused on that point, that there are no allegations against Americans here, against the Trump campaign. But do these indictments rule out the possibility of that kind of investigation ongoing or down the road?
No. No, I mean, it's what Mueller's doing. He's a very skilled prosecutor, is doing what very skilled prosecutors do. Which is when they have, you know, they unroll it as they have it, and it's appropriate to say what Rosenstein said, which is that's not what this indictment is not about this, it's about this, and that's what good prosecutors do. But it doesn't foreclose the possibility of further future indictments of people who may have been connected in some way.
Now, an issue in this ongoing investigation, Katie, is whether President Trump himself would talk to the Mueller people if he could mm-hmm. be forced to do so. Is this settled law at this point? Do we know how much authority they have to say, yeah, President, you got to talk to us?
You know, it's more about custom, I think, than it is law. I mean, to the extent that the law has addressed these questions. I mean, fortunately, it hasn't happened a lot in our history. you know, presidents have been required to respond. So if you think about United States versus Nixon, the Watergate case again, you know, that the court said the needs for evidence in a criminal case override the executive privilege claim that he was making, right, against the tapes. Now, in that case, it wasn't Nixon being forced to actually testify himself. It was the tapes that they wanted. But we know that President Clinton was called before the grand jury and testified. I mean, they negotiated how to do that in sort of the most formal way, and they didn't require him to come in person. They allowed him to do it by tape. But the precedent is that the president is not above the law in terms of the demands of a criminal case. So, but I think the custom is, and I think Mueller is appropriately being very cautious about this, the custom is to try to negotiate the rules of a meeting as opposed to having to subpoena someone, a president.
We're talking about the latest developments in the Mueller investigation with Katie Herriger. She's a political science professor from Wake Forest University and an expert on federal special prosecutors. 12 Russian agents were charged last week with hacking into various Democratic websites and Democratic organizations. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to these new charges? Is the Mueller investigation a witch hunt, as President Trump insists, or not? What do you think about the president's relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin? Should he have canceled today's meeting with President Putin in the wake of these charges against Russian intelligence officials? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 elections. A dozen Russian agents were charged with hacking into the DNC, the Clinton presidential campaign, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Katie Herriger is with us, professor of political science at Wake Forest University and an expert on federal special prosecutors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on these latest charges? Do you think the Mueller investigation should continue, or is it time to wrap it up? Should the president have called off today's meeting with Vladimir Putin, as some Democrats have suggested, or was he right to keep it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Want to give a listen to President Trump here at this joint news conference with Vladimir Putin, talking about the Mueller investigation, saying it's harmed U.S.-Russia relations.
The probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it. People are being brought out to the fore. So far that I know, virtually none of it related to the campaign. And they're going to have to try really hard to find somebody that did relate to the campaign. That was a clean campaign.
The president focusing on the allegations of collusion, the idea that members of his campaign may have coordinated with Russian officials. That is just one part, as I understand it, Katie, of the Mueller probe. He's looking at a few different areas, including foreign interference, regardless of whether it was coordinated with Americans, right?
Exactly. In fact, when he was appointed, it said quite clearly that that was one of the primary things he was supposed to look at, was what role the Russians played. So, yes, and it also says, and other things discovered in the course of the investigation, right? And so I think some of the earliest indictments of Manafort, for example, and Flynn were things that had the FBI had already begun to uncover prior to Mueller even being appointed. But those were things that, you know, as they investigated him, because of his past, Manafort, for example, past relationship with the Russians and with the Ukrainian government, they uncovered the various financial dealings that he's been indicted with now. So when prosecutors uncover, I mean, again, normal prosecutors do that too. If they uncover evidence of crime while they're engaged in an investigation of something else, it's not like they say, oh, never mind, I wasn't looking for that, so I'm not going to do anything about it.
Let's go to our callers now. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I disagree with the president that everyone knows there was no collusion. I think that's what's being investigated. And seeing how his campaign manager, Manafort, who he lied about how significant he was to his campaign, Manafort was working on behalf of Ukrainian, Russian-supported Ukrainians, where that's where this term fake news comes from. That's something that they used in the Ukraine. It's something that the FSB and the KGB has used for a long, long time. And for the president of the United States to take the side of a man who's been implicated by a Dutch court in the shooting down of a civilian airline, by a British court of poisoning a former agent with a nuclear, polonium, and then the chemical warfare of these two other former agents, plus invading the Crimea with soldiers without insignia, which is an international war crime, to take the word of this man who spent his whole career in the arts of deception over the U.S. intelligence agencies is bordering on treason, I think. I think it's incomprehensible that a U.S. president would act this way. After a tour of where he inserted himself in foreign countries' domestic business, insulted Angela Merkel and the Prime Minister of England and the EU, and, you know, he is doing what Putin has desired, to split the alliance between NATO and the United States. And
Willem, I'm going to jump in because I want to get Katie's response and bring on other callers as well in the time we have left. Willem's playing out the case against Vladimir Putin here and reiterating what a lot of people, as you said, Republicans and Democrats are saying, you're picking this guy over the U.S. intelligence community that's investigating these crimes.
Right. And people that you appointed to those intelligence communities. it's surprising. I think what John McCain said about its unprecedented nature is also true. And as the caller said, it couldn't be, especially the wedge that has been driven with our European allies, is precisely the kind of thing Putin has wanted for a long time. He would love to see NATO dissolved.
Willem, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Aaron in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I saw the president and Mr. Putin's press conference, and I thought it was very good. I'm glad that he did bring up the server because it was the DNC that claimed that the Russians hacked their server, and yet they never handed their server over to the FBI, which is very curious. But according to QAnon, they have everything. So all this is semantics. He knows everything, all the dirty dealings. Vault 7, which was released by WikiLeaks, proves that the CIA has software to make anything look like it came from anywhere, including Russia.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Katie, I bring up that server that the president referenced a lot in this press conference. My understanding from the indictments is that the FBI did have a forensic read of relevant servers on this, even if they didn't ultimately take physical servers into their possession. That's my understanding based on a quick read.
And I'll just to correct one thing that he said, the DNC did not report that their server had been invaded. The FBI notified the DNC that it had happened. So it wasn't the DNC that made the first allegation. It was the FBI in their investigation notified the DNC, your server has been hacked.
Thanks for the call, Aaron. So as we look ahead, Katie, what are you watching for next in this investigation? As always, it seems like Robert Mueller plays things pretty close to the vest, doesn't tip people off as to what might be coming. Today, of course, we have now the arrest of a Russian graduate student at American University, the accusation that she was coordinating connections between American politicians, advocacy groups, and Russian officials. What are you watching for now?
Well, I think the sort of next steps seem to be, I mean, really there's sort of two things that we haven't heard much from Mueller about, and I think the pressure is on him to say something one way or the other about, and one is the obstruction of justice investigation and around the firing of Comey, and the other is whether there were any members of his campaign staff who worked with the Russians. Those are the things I think, you know, now that the evidence has been, the very clear evidence has been laid out of what the Russians did, the question that's still there, I think, is did they coordinate with anybody in the campaign? So I think there's a considerable amount of pressure being mounted by both the president and his surrogates for this to get wrapped up, as they say. And I think I'm sure that Mueller feels that pressure, but he also is going to continue, I think, to work in the kind of methodical way that he does. He's not going to change his MO as a prosecutor just because the president wants him to.
We'll leave it there for now. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
Katie Herriger is a professor of political science at Wake Forest University and an expert on federal special prosecutors. Talked with her about today's meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin and the newest charges in the Mueller investigation.